Imagine waking up in a straitjacket. Right. You're bound totally tight in this padded room, and the very first thing you hear is the sound of cockroaches laughing at you.
Oh, God. Yeah, just awful.
Right. Not just crawling on you, but literally cackling inside your mind.
It's such a visceral way to start.
It really is. And then, before you can even process that nightmare, the door gets kicked open. But it's not a doctor. It's your mother.
Yep.
And she's riding in a white Humvee. She calls down an orbital space laser strike from a satellite to obliterate a pack of mutant velociraptors.
As one does.
Exactly, as mothers do. And when she gets splashed with flesh-melting acid, she just casually saws her own arm off, cauterizes a stump with a blue flame, and says, all right, let's go.
It's just incredible.
Well, welcome to the deep dives, everybody.
It really is probably one of the most relentless, sensory overloading pieces of fiction I've ever analyzed. I mean, you're trying to find your footing, and the ground just keeps shifting underneath you.
Yeah, today we are looking at a translated narrative excerpt, simply known as like titty texty, which translates to attached text.
Right.
And look, we read a lot of wild stuff for this show, but this piece, I mean, it takes the unwritten contract between author and reader, shreds it, sets it on fire, and just throws the ashes right in your face.
It totally does.
It's an absolute fever dream. I had to read the source material 3 times just to make sure I wasn't hallucinating the words on the page.
I don't blame you. It absolutely demands that kind of rereading, because what we have here isn't just a story that, you know, hops between genres.
Right.
It's a text that forcefully crashes them into one another at, like, terminal velocity.
Yeah, terminal velocity is the perfect way to put it.
We're talking about a space where claustrophobic psychological horror, hyper-advanced cyberpunk technology, dark occult fantasy, and extremely violent religious warfare all occupy the exact same room.
And what's wild is that it actually works.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't just feel like random noise. There's a really terrifying logic to it.
There really is.
So as we get into this, I want you, the listener, to think about how extreme chaos can actually heighten a sense of dread.
Which sounds counterintuitive, right?
Totally counterintuitive. Because how does a writer throw orbital space lasers, giant black pyramids, and demonic raptors at you without losing the actual grounded human terror of the situation?
It's a massive risk.
Huge risk. By all accounts, this much genre blending should just turn into a cartoon, like a joke. But it doesn't. It's utterly terrifying.
And it achieves that terror by attacking the protagonist's reality from the inside out.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, we don't start with the epic space lasers, you know? We start in the smallest, most suffocating space imaginable. Yeah. We start inside the protagonist's shattered mind.
Right, right. Let's jump straight into that opening scene.
Let's do it.
So we meet our protagonist, Toivo. He wakes up in this padded cell. The lights are flickering. He's strapped into a straitjacket.
Very classic, old-school asylum horror setup.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But instantly, the text violates his personal space. The room is swarming with cockroaches. And he hears this voice, but it's inside his own head, just taunting him.
Yep, the mocking voice.
It says, ha-ha, religious psychosis, psychosis. And that voice is layered with this horrific, roach-like chirping sound.
The sound design, honestly, of that opening paragraph is brilliant.
Oh, it really is.
By blending the cackling voice with the chirping of the roaches, the author is collapsing the boundary between the physical world and Toivo's psychological state.
Oh, wow.
Like, you literally can't tell what's actually in the room and what's a symptom of his crumbling mind.
It's so visceral. He feels the slimy legs of these roaches crawling up his pant legs, getting under his shirt. It makes your skin crawl just reading it.
Totally. It engages your physical empathy immediately.
And then he looks through the little window in the armored door, and there's this massive hooded figure standing out there.
All right.
But when he looks inside the hood, there's no face. It's just a writhing mass of more roach faces.
Which establishes this primal organic revulsion, you know?
Yeah, it's just disgust.
Roaches represent filth, decay, things that survive in the darkest, most neglected corners of the world.
Absolutely.
But pay close attention to what happens next, because the threat vector completely changes.
Oh, this part gave me whiplash.
A voice over an intercom orders these entities, these things called black angels, to fetch Toivo for an acid bath.
Yeah, so you're bracing yourself for some giant roach monster to walk in, like some huge bug.
Right. You expect an organic monster.
But the door opens, and it's 2 men in pristine black tuxedos.
It's so jarring.
And they have pitch black eyes. And they don't bite him or drag him into the dark. They shoot him point blank in the chest with a high-tech stun gun.
The whiplash there is highly intentional.
It has to be.
We go from a deeply organic, almost mythological fear of insects and decay straight into sterile, bureaucratic, technological menace.
Wow, yeah.
I mean, men in suits with stun guns belong to a totally different lexicon of fear.
Yeah, they're not monsters under the bed.
Exactly. They represent state control, secret police, government black sites.
It feels like a DJ doing a live, chaotic mashup of two totally incompatible tracks, you know?
Oh, that's a great analogy.
Like, you've got the grimy, squelchy audio of a 1970s asylum horror movie playing on one turntable, right?
Yeah.
And then suddenly, the DJ violently crossfades to a sleek, paranoid 1990s cyberpunk corporate thriller on the other.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. And the text leans hard into that cold clinical track.
It really does. Because after he gets hit with the stun gun, Toivo's kind of drifting in and out of consciousness.
Right.
And the next thing he knows, there are surgeons surrounding him and they're shoving tubes down into his lungs.
Right. So the invasion of his body shifts from the external feeling of bugs on his skin to the internal mechanical penetration of medical instruments.
It's horrific. And there's this one moment of pure desperation where Toivo manages to gag, and he actually spits on the doctor's face mask.
Such a human reaction.
Yeah. But the doctor doesn't get angry in a normal way.
No, he doesn't.
He leans in, and he hisses like a snake.
So again, the DJ crossfades back to that animalistic, organic horror.
Exactly. The doctor's hissing. But then he waves a perfectly sterile, sharp surgical scalpel right in front of Toivo's nose, promising to end his life with just a little flick of the wrist.
It's such a bizarre mix of imagery.
And then he takes a small metal hammer and just taps it against Toivo's skull until he blacks out again.
The shift in tactile sensation there is what makes it so disturbing.
The tapping.
Yeah, we've moved from the slimy, unpredictable scurrying of the roaches to the cold, precise, metallic tap of a hammer on bone. It's an assault on Toivo's ontological status.
Wait, his ontological status. Break that down for me.
Sure, yeah. So ontology is the philosophical study of being, right? Of what it actually means to exist as a person.
Okay, following.
The text is systematically destroying Toivo's sense of existing as a human being.
Oh, man.
He's paralyzed by the stun gun. He's intubated, strapped down, and his head is being tapped with a hammer like he's a faulty carburetor in a mechanic shop.
Wow, yeah. Like he's just a broken machine.
Exactly. He isn't a person to them. He's raw material. The horror transitions from I am in danger to I am an object.
That is deeply chilling. And that makes the next scene even more terrifying, honestly.
It really ramps up.
He wakes up again and he's tied to a chair. There are these blindingly bright lights shining directly into his one good eye.
Because the other one is presumably swollen shut from the abuse.
Right. And he realizes he's in a room made entirely of mirrors.
But they aren't just mirrors.
No, they're two-way glass. There are researchers and doctors behind those mirrors, taking notes, just watching him suffer.
It's a classic panopticon structure.
A panopticon. Okay, that's the old prison concept, right?
Yes.
Where the guards are in a central tower and the prisoners never know exactly when they're being watched?
Precisely. In a panopticon, because you can't see the observers, you have to assume you are always being watched.
So you police yourself.
Exactly. It forces the prisoner to internalize the surveillance. The mirror room serves the exact same psychological function.
Man, that's heavy.
Toivo is stripped of all privacy, all autonomy. He is entirely at the mercy of this unseen clinical bureaucracy.
And then, just to push the paranoia right off the cliff, a booming voice comes over a hidden microphone in the ceiling and says, "Welcome to Vladivostok."
Ah, that line. That line is the linchpin of the whole opening.
It's such a specific, jarring detail.
Mm-hmm.
We're dealing with hissing doctors and roaches, and suddenly we're geographically anchored.
It changes everything.
The voice laughs and says that the Black Ones have installed a microchip in Toivo's brain, calling him a unique test subject.
Yeah.
Vladivostok, a microchip. We're suddenly talking about global conspiracies.
The author chooses Vladivostok very, very deliberately.
Why Vladivostok specifically, you think?
Well, if you think about the geographic and cultural imagination of the West, Vladivostok is the absolute edge of the map.
That's true. It's incredibly far east.
It's a massive, cold, highly militarized port city on the far eastern coast of Russia. It evokes isolation, the Cold War, secret military black sites.
Oh, sure.
And an insurmountable distance from home.
Right. Nobody's just dropping by Vladivostok.
Exactly. The moment that voice says Vladivostok, the walls of the padded room effectively fall away.
Because it's no longer just a crazy person's cell.
Right. We realize this isn't a local madhouse. It's a vast systemic geopolitical nightmare.
Wow.
And the microchip is the ultimate violation, really.
Because it's inside his head.
Yes. They haven't just imprisoned his body, they've colonized his brain.
I want to pause here, actually, and look at a huge red flag the text planted right at the beginning.
Okay, let's hear it.
Because we need to talk about that very first voice he heard, the one laughing about religious psychosis.
Yes.
If the narrative explicitly diagnoses our protagonist with psychosis on page one, how are we supposed to read all of this?
Is the big question.
I mean, are the tuxedo men, the snake doctors, and the microchip literal things happening in this story's reality? Or are we, you know, the listener, just trapped inside the hallucination of a guy who's completely lost his grip on reality?
You're hitting on the core friction of the text right there.
It's hard to ignore, right?
Very hard. By introducing the diagnosis of psychosis instantly, the author gives you a permission slip to doubt everything.
It totally destabilizes your trust in Toivo as a narrator.
Absolutely. Yeah. However, the sheer tactile density of the writing.
The hammer, the acid.
Yes. The specific feeling of the scalpel, the heat of the lights, the exact sound of the metal hammer. All of that forces you to experience it as real.
Yeah, you can't just dismiss it.
Whether it's a literal microchip or a metaphor for a psychic break, the trauma Toivo is enduring is absolute.
It's real to him.
Exactly. But the text doesn't let you settle comfortably into the it's all a dream theory for long.
Oh, definitely not.
Because right when you start thinking this is an intimate psychological thriller, the camera pulls back and the scale of the horror explodes.
Explodes is the right word.
Yeah.
Because Toivo mentions his head starts buzzing.
Yeah.
Which, again, could be the microchip or it could be his brain breaking.
Right.
And he says he has a vision in the spirit.
In the spirit. A very religious phrasing.
Very. And suddenly, he's seeing the building he's trapped in from the outside.
The shift in perspective here is wild.
It really is. And it's not a hospital. It's not a military bunker in Vladivostok. It's a massive, towering black pyramid.
The black pyramid. We've gone from clinical cyberpunk straight into dark occult geometry.
It's such a heavy image.
Think about it. Pyramids are ancient monuments to death designed to channel power from the mortal realm to the divine.
Right, they're tombs.
Yes. By housing this high-tech microchip implanting facility inside a black pyramid, the text marries futuristic sci-fi paranoia with ancient esoteric evil.
And outside this pyramid, all hell has literally broken loose.
Literally.
There is a full-scale war happening in the courtyard. I have to just list the combatants here because it sounds like the chaotic scribblings of a madman, but the text treats it with total deadly seriousness.
Please do. The list is amazing.
Okay, so on one side, you have these white armored Humvees and a literal cavalry force, like people on horseback.
A fascinating juxtaposition right off the bat. Modern military transport driving alongside ancient cavalry charges.
And they're being led by Toivo's mother, who goes by the call sign Angel Face.
Such a great name.
But wait until you hear what they're fighting.
This is the best part.
They're not fighting Russian soldiers or security guards. The text describes drooling black velociraptors boosting out of the ground.
Naturally.
And they're being ridden by creatures wearing pitch black robes.
Nice.
And pouring out of the surrounding forest are these massive hairy demons that are physically pulsating with a red light.
This is where that DJ mashup analogy you used earlier gets cranked to deafening volume.
Oh, absolutely. The speakers are blowing out.
We've got Humvees, orbital tech, velociraptors, prehistoric beasts, occult pyramids, and pulsating demons.
What really struck me when reading this section was the intense color coding.
Yes. Let's talk about the colors.
The text is very specific about it.
Ah.
You have the white Humvees. You have the blue flame of a weapon that Angel Face uses.
Very clean colors.
Exactly. And that crisp white and blue is clashing violently against this sea of black and red.
The contrast is extreme.
The black pyramid, the black velociraptors, the black robes, and the hairy demons flashing with red light. It's incredibly visual.
That color palette is a crucial survival mechanism for the reader, actually.
Oh, really? How so?
Well, when you have this much conceptual absurdity, raptor-riding cultists fighting military jeeps, your brain struggles to process the logistics of the battlefield.
Yeah, you kind of lose your bearings.
Right. The author uses primal, mythic color coding to anchor you. White and blue traditionally signify purity, divine intervention, clean technology, and cold precision.
Like the good guys.
Exactly. And black and red instantly telegraph corruption, the demonic, blood, hellfire, and ancient evil.
That makes a lot of sense.
You might not understand why a velociraptor is there, but because it's black and fighting a white Humvee, your brain immediately categorizes the morality of the combatants.
Right. You instantly know who to root for.
Exactly.
But, I mean, I get that it helps sort the good guys from the bad guys. But if I'm putting myself in the listener's shoes,
sure.
If I'm reading a story and it throws jeeps, raptors, and cavalry into the exact same sentence, doesn't it risk totally deflating the tension?
That's a valid concern.
Like, does the sheer absurdity of it dilute the stakes? If anything can happen, does anything matter?
That is the tightrope the author is walking right there.
Yeah, it feels like it could fall apart at any second.
In a lesser writer's hands, this turns into a cartoon. It becomes farcical.
Like a bad B-movie.
Yes. But this text bypasses the rational, critical part of your brain, the part that says raptors and Humvees don't belong together, and it speaks directly to your lizard brain.
Okay, but how?
It does this through extreme kinetic pacing and visceral consequence.
Oh, you mean the gore?
Yes. There is nothing abstract or cartoony about the violence here. It is incredibly wet and heavy.
Yeah, you're right. It doesn't hold back.
The text doesn't pause to explain the lore of where the raptors came from, you know?
Right, there's no encyclopedic entry on demon dinosaurs.
Exactly. Instead, it describes the heavy machine guns mounted on the Humvees tearing into the hairy demons and turning them into bloody pulp.
Uh-huh, I see.
It focuses on the sheer physical weight of the artillery, the sound of the gunfire, the splatter of gore. It forces you to accept the reality of the threat through the sheer physical trauma being inflicted on the page.
It's sensory overload as a narrative tactic. You're just trying to keep up.
Precisely. You don't have time to question the raptors because they're currently biting a horse's head off.
God, yeah. But right in the middle of this absolute meat grinder of a battlefield, the text miraculously finds a focal point.
It zooms in?
Yes. It zeroes in on the architect of this rescue mission. And I want to spend some serious time here, because this character is unbelievable. We need to talk about Angel Face, Toivo's mother.
Oh, Angel Face. She is, without a doubt, one of the most compelling and bizarre archetypes of a mother figure I have ever encountered in speculative fiction.
She's just incredible.
She is where the themes of maternal devotion, religious zealotry, and cybernetic ultraviolence violently intersect.
Violently is the key word.
Yay.
Let's track her movements in this battle, because it reads like the most intense action sequence imaginable.
Walk us through it.
First, her weapon. She pulls this thing off her back. It's described as a sword covered in arcane symbols, but it's also a rifle. And it has curved blades.
Right.
It's this impossible hybrid of an ancient holy relic and a modern assault weapon.
It perfectly mirrors the world itself, right? Ancient magic fused with modern ballistics.
Yes. So she's wading through this chaotic battlefield. One of the enemies, described as a black angel, throws a projectile at her. The text calls it a fan-like explosive.
Okay.
Angel Face doesn't even flinch. She points her hybrid sword rifle and shoots a literal bolt of electricity out of it, detonating the explosive midair.
It establishes her instantly as an apex predator on this battlefield.
Oh, totally.
I mean, her reaction time is superhuman. She isn't just surviving the chaos, she's dominating it.
But the explosion has consequences. When she shoots it out of the air, a splash of black acid rains down and hits her arm.
This is where things get truly insane.
Right, and the text makes it clear. This acid starts rapidly melting her flesh down to the bone.
It's an agonizing injury.
Yeah. Now, any normal character, any normal human, would scream, drop their weapon, fall to the ground in shock.
Of course.
What does Angel Face do? Without missing a beat, she uses the curved blade of her own weapon to chop her melting arm completely off.
Just boom, gone.
And then she switches the weapon setting and uses a jet of blue flame to cauterize her own bleeding stump.
Let's just sit with the psychology of that moment for a second.
Please, because my brain short-circuited reading it.
The radical pragmatism is staggering.
Think about how mothers are usually portrayed in rescue narratives.
Usually they're terrified.
Right. They're often defined by their emotional distress, their desperate pleading, their vulnerability. Their strength comes from their emotional endurance.
Like they push through the tears. Exactly. But here, the author completely strips away that melodrama.
Completely.
Her love for Toivo isn't expressed through tears or monologues. It's expressed through a brutal, unstoppable, mechanized momentum.
Yeah. She doesn't cry for him. She bleeds for him. Literally.
She views her own body as expendable hardware. If an arm is compromised and slowing down the mission to save her son, the arm gets jettisoned.
It's terrifying. She's like a mix between a biblical avenging angel with a flaming sword and a T-800 Terminator from a 1980s James Cameron movie.
That's a spot-on description.
She just will not stop. And she doesn't even take a breath after amputating her own limb.
No, she keeps moving.
Still screaming through the pain, she reaches over with her one good hand and presses a button on her shoulder armor. And I need you to explain this to me, because the text specifically notes that this button is labeled 12 Disciples.
Ah, the 12 Disciples button. It's the most brilliant thematic detail in the text.
Because when she pushes it, literal lasers shoot down from outer space and vaporize the hairy demons on the battlefield.
Yeah.
Orbital space lasers, named after the apostles.
Think about what this implies about the universe of this story.
It's wild.
The author has taken deeply sacred, ancient religious iconography, the foundational followers of Christ, and literalized them into a mechanized orbital strike system.
That blows my mind.
In our world, faith is an abstract comfort, right? You pray for divine intervention.
Yeah, you hope things work out.
In the world of Litteti Texti, heaven is a tactical command center. Divine wrath isn't a metaphor. It's artillery delivered via satellite targeting systems.
That is so incredibly bleak, but awesome.
And Angel Face represents this perfectly. She is a holy crusader, but her faith is executed through hyper-advanced, brutal technology.
I love that concept, cyberpunk theology.
Cyberpunk theology, exactly.
But I do have to push back a little on the execution here.
Oh, okay.
Right after she calls down the wrath of God from a satellite, she jumps right back into the physical melee. She's got a cauterized stump for an arm, but she swings her sword, splits a velociraptor's skull right down the middle, and then cleanly decapitates the black angel who threw the acid at her.
Incredible sequence.
It is. But after all of this, the acid, the self-amputation, the space lasers, the decapitations, she looks at the doors of the pyramid and just says, completely deadpan. Okay, now we know how to get in.
The absolute understatement of the century.
Exactly. But here's my question. Doesn't her reaction kind of undercut the horror for the reader?
How do you mean?
Well, if she can lose a limb, cauterize it, and respond with a cool tactical quip, does she feel less human?
I see what you're getting at.
Like, does it lower the emotional stakes if our rescuing hero is practically an invulnerable machine? If I don't believe she can be stopped, why should I be scared?
That is a phenomenal critique, and it highlights a very specific type of narrative tension.
Right, because I wasn't really worried about her dying anymore.
And you're right, we stop fearing for Angel Face's physical safety in the traditional sense. She clearly owns the battlefield.
Total ownership.
But I'd argue that her hyper-competence doesn't lower the stakes. It actually deepens a much darker kind of existential horror.
Really? How so? If she's winning, where's the horror?
The horror lies in what her transformation implies about the world. Think about the environment she is navigating.
A war zone.
Right. If a figure historically associated with nurturing and life must literally carve away pieces of her own humanity, sever her own flesh, and call down orbital fire just to reach the front door of this facility.
Oh, man.
What kind of unimaginable hell is waiting inside?
Oh, wow.
Her stoicism is a dark mirror reflecting the brutality of the world. The environment is so toxic, so violently hostile, that you have to become a monster just to survive a walk across the courtyard.
That makes total sense. She had to adapt to the nightmare.
Exactly. She has weaponized her maternal instinct to the point of self-mutilation. That's a tragedy masked as an action sequence.
Wow. Okay, when you put it like that,
yeah.
Her strength isn't triumphant, it's desperate.
Deeply desperate.
She's the heavy artillery, breaking the siege from the outside. But as you pointed out, she only got them to the front door.
Right, they still have to get in.
Getting inside the pyramid, infiltrating the facility to find Toivo, requires a completely different approach. And this introduces us to the next phase of the rescue and a new character named John.
Yes, John's infiltration.
And things get incredibly dark here.
If the battle outside was defined by explosive energy, wide open spaces, and sci-fi weaponry, the infiltration shifts the genre again.
Oh, huge shift.
As soon as they cross the threshold of the Black Pyramid, we move away from action thriller and descend straight into claustrophobic, biomechanical horror. The very physics of the world seem to change.
Well, the way they cross that threshold is stomach churning.
It really is.
Remember, Angel Face said, now we know how to get in, right after she decapitated that black angel.
Yes.
Well, she meant it literally. John picks up the freshly severed head of the enemy, walks up to the pyramid doors, and presses the dead face against a biometric scanner.
A macabre key card.
And the doors don't just slide open. The text describes them as being lined with teeth, retracting open like a maw.
A maw, a mouth. This is where the biomechanical horror takes root.
It's so unsettling.
The architecture is no longer sterile or inanimate. A door is a mouth. A keycard is a bleeding, severed head.
Yeah, the building is alive.
The text is telling us that the Black Pyramid isn't just a building housing evil. It functions as a living, demonic organism. And to navigate the digestive tract of this beast, the heroes have to engage with its grim, fleshy logic.
It's an absolute desecration of the human body.
Truly.
And the moment they step through those toothy doors, they are immediately swarmed.
Right.
But it's not raptors or hairy demons inside. The text says they are confronted by possessed, slithering nurses and doctors.
Yes.
And John, without a second of hesitation, unleashes a flamethrower and just roasts them alive.
There is a profound symmetry here that we really can't overlook.
Yes, the dark mirroring. The medical staff. In the very first section, we saw Toivo strapped to a chair, totally helpless, while clean, sterile doctors tapped his skull and threatened him with scalpels.
Right. They had all the power.
They had all the clinical authority. And here, those same medical figures reappear, but they've been stripped of their sterile power. Now they are literal, slithering monsters crawling on the floor, and they're being incinerated by John.
It is a violent reversal of power dynamics. The torturers are reduced to pestilence, and that pestilence is cleansed by fire.
Cleansed by fire, I like that.
But John doesn't have time to dwell on the poetic justice because he has to navigate deeper.
Right.
To find Toivo, he has to locate what the text refers to as the black heart of the pyramid.
And how does he find the black heart? He consults a map.
Of course.
But of course, in this living nightmare of a building, it's not a paper blueprint.
No, it wouldn't be.
He finds a map stretched out on the wall made entirely of human skin.
Again, we see the absolute utilitarian degradation of humanity. A person's skin is reduced to mundane infrastructure.
It's just so grotesque. So Angel Face is too wounded to continue down. John leaves her behind to hold the perimeter. And he gets into an elevator to descend into the depths.
Into the belly of the beast.
Literally. As the elevator is going down, he encounters an occult security lock, a physical barrier stopping the descent.
Right.
And John knows exactly how to bypass it. He takes blood from a severed arm, presumably one he brought with him from the carnage above, and smears it on the lock to hack the system.
This specific action, using blood to hack a lock, forces us to examine the duality of how flesh and blood are used in this narrative.
Well, that's interesting.
Up to this point, during the infiltration, the human body has been treated as purely mechanical. Mm-hmm. A head is a key. Skin is a map. Blood is a passcode, a crude fluid mechanism to short-circuit a lock.
Yeah, like oil in the machine.
It is a profoundly profane perspective on life. Reducing the sacred human form to spare parts and passwords.
But right after he does that, right after he smears blood from a mutilated limb onto a demonic lock, the elevator continues its plunge into the dark. And John, this hardened warrior carrying a flamethrower and severed body parts, suddenly collapses to his knees on the floor of the elevator.
It's such a striking image.
And he starts praying, fervently. Weeping, praying to Jesus for Toivo's safety.
That juxtaposition is the emotional anchor of the entire narrative.
It gave me whiplash, honestly. I struggle to reconcile it.
I can see why.
Like, how do those two realities coexist in the same man, in the same breath?
Yeah.
You're hacking a blood lock with a dead man's arm, and 30 seconds later, you're on your knees having a deeply vulnerable spiritual communion.
It's jarring, but it works because it answers the fundamental thesis of the world the author has built.
How do you mean?
In this universe, spiritual warfare is not a metaphor.
Right.
It isn't a theological debate happening in a church. It is tangible, bloody, and physical.
Like actual combat.
Yes. The physical corruption they're fighting, the skin maps, the living doors, the demons, is the literal physical manifestation of spiritual evil. Therefore, to fight it, the righteous resistance has to be equally physical and violent. John has to use the flamethrower. He has to use the bloodlock.
He has to play by the rules of the realm.
Exactly. But the prayer serves as a crucial course correction for the reader and the character. It reminds us that the violence itself isn't the goal.
Right. The gore is just a means to an end.
The gore is just the horrific toll exacted on the rescuers. When John drops to his knees, he sheds the identity of the brutal commando and returns to his core identity. A man terrified for a child's soul.
That is so powerful.
The blood used on the lock was a profane mechanism, but John's tears and his prayer restore the concept of sacrifice back to something sacred.
That makes a lot of sense. It keeps the heroes from just becoming monsters themselves.
Exactly.
It grounds the absolute insanity of the world building in this very fragile human desperation.
We need that humanity to care about the outcome.
We are right there with him in the dark,
right,
plunging toward the black heart. But the narrative pulls a brilliant trick here.
A massive redirect.
The second John reaches the bottom, the text doesn't follow him out of the elevator doors. It violently snaps our perspective back.
We don't get to see him step out.
No. We're instantly yanked out of the rescue mission and thrown right back into Toivo's body, still strapped to the chair, still blinded by the lights in the mirror room.
The pacing here is masterful.
Yeah.
The author builds all this momentum with the descent and then holds you in suspense, returning you to the ultimate point of vulnerability just as the climax hits.
Let's talk about that climax, because it is biblical in its scale.
Oh, absolutely.
We're back with Toivo. Suddenly, a deafening red general alarm blares through the room.
The outside world is finally breaching the inner sanctum.
The sterile, controlled atmosphere shatters. The medical staff behind the two-way mirrors begin to twitch erratically.
The demonic possession taking over.
And then the room itself begins to bleed.
Literally bleed.
Red blood starts pouring rapidly, uncontrollably, from holes in the walls. It's not a trickle, it's a flood. The text says it quickly rises up to Toivo's knees.
The imagery of the room filling with blood operates on multiple symbolic levels here.
Break them down for me.
Well, throughout the first section, Toivo was the one being drained, probed, and invaded, right?
Right.
The medical environment was an illusion of clean, cold, sterile control. When the walls literally start bleeding, that illusion ruptures. The underlying violence, the true black heart of the facility, is made manifest.
I see. It's like the building is revealing its true face.
Exactly. It's vomiting up its true nature.
It's terrifying. He's paralyzed in the chair, and the blood is just rising around him.
Yes, but on a thematic level, it also serves as a dark baptism.
A baptism.
Think about it. He is completely submerged in the physical manifestation of horror and sacrifice just seconds before his salvation.
Wow, that's incredibly poetic. And the salvation arrives like a thunderclap.
It doesn't dawdle.
Just as the blood is rising, a massive bang echoes through the room. John has arrived. He fires his weapon directly at the two-way mirror door. The glass completely shatters. And the moment the glass breaks, the blood gushes out of the room like a bursting dam.
The shattering of the mirror is the most important symbolic action of the climax.
Oh, for sure. We talked earlier about how the mirror room functioned as a panopticon, a system of total unseen control and surveillance.
Right.
When John shatters that mirror with gunfire, he isn't just breaking a physical barrier.
No, it's way more than that.
He is destroying the concept of the observer's omnipotence.
Exactly. He violently collapses the boundary between the ones watching and the one being watched, bringing the raw, chaotic violence of the outside war directly into the sterile observation deck.
I kept thinking of it like bursting a massive infected blister.
That is a perfect, gross analogy.
Right. It's an incredibly violent image. The echoing gunfire, the exploding glass, a literal tidal wave of blood rushing out into the hallway, and the burning doctors howling in agony. But it feels so necessary.
It is necessary.
It's the violent release of all that venomous psychological pressure that's been building inside Toivo's head since the very first paragraph. It has to burst.
The tension reaches absolute critical mass, the blister pops, and then there is a profound, sudden stillness.
The aftermath.
The text pivots instantly to the resolution.
It's such a stark contrast. Toivo fades from consciousness as the glass shatters.
He finally passes out.
And when he opens his eyes again, the environment has entirely transformed. He's no longer in a padded cell. He's no longer trapped in a bleeding mirror room.
He's safe.
He is gently bouncing in the back of a Humvee driving away from the nightmare. And he realizes he is resting his head in Angel Face's lap.
The mother and son reunited.
And his first words, after all the torture, after the snake doctors and the microchips, aren't about himself. He looks up and asks, "Mother, are you wounded?"
And her response provides the emotional catharsis the reader has been starving for.
She smiles at him. The text specifically calls it her angel smile, shining through the obvious immense pain of missing an arm.
She's still the fierce protector.
She softly shushes him, telling him everything is okay. And then she takes a syringe and injects medicine into his neck, putting him peacefully to sleep for the ride home.
The narrative structure here is incredibly elegant because it brings us full circle. but it overwrites the initial trauma.
Overwrites it. How do you mean?
Think back to the beginning. Toivo's nightmare began with hostile, forced medical interventions.
Right, the intubation.
He was shot with a stun gun, forcibly intubated, threatened with scalpels, and implanted with a microchip by sinister, hissing doctors who saw him as an object.
Yeah, his bodily autonomy was completely violated by needles and tools. Yes,
exactly. Now, look at the ending.
Oh, well. Right.
It concludes with another medical intervention, a needle injected directly into his neck.
But it's totally different.
The context has completely shifted. It is no longer an invasion. It is an act of profound maternal care.
Yeah, it's meant to heal, not hurt.
It brings a comforting release from pain. The author takes the very instruments of his torture, syringes and drugs, and reclaims them as instruments of peace and salvation. The hostile trauma is neutralized by maternal love.
That is beautiful.
Yeah.
And tragic. And so exhausting. Yeah. I feel like I need to go lie down just having talked through it all.
It's a lot to process, for sure.
We have journeyed from the claustrophobia of a cockroach-infested padded cell out into a sprawling, logic-defying war zone of orbital lasers, raptors, and occult blood magic, all the way down into the bleeding heart of a pyramid, only to end up with a quiet moment of a mother putting her child to sleep.
It's a testament to the power of the text. It proves that you can blend fundamentally incompatible genres, clinical cyberpunk, psychological thriller, dark fantasy, biblical warfare, and still deliver a cohesive, deeply emotional punch.
It really does.
It doesn't ask you to map out the logistics of its world. It demands that you survive the emotional roller coaster alongside Toivo.
It absolutely forces you to feel the story rather than just read it. But as we wrap up this exploration, I want to pull one last thread.
Oh, okay.
I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over, something that builds on everything we've unpacked today, but casts a very long, very dark shadow over the entire epic tale.
I'm intrigued.
I want you to think back to the very first moments of the text, before the Humvees, before the orbital lasers, before the map made of human skin and the bleeding walls.
Right at the start.
Consider that very first voice Toivo heard in the dark, whispering in his mind alongside the chirping cockroaches. The cold, mocking voice that diagnosed him with religious psychosis.
Right. We touched on it earlier.
We acknowledged it, yeah. But what if we take that clinical diagnosis with absolute, literal seriousness?
Oh, wow.
What if none of this epic biblical battle was physically real?
So no raptors.
Think about it. What if the white Humvees, the 12 disciples' orbital strike button, the roaring black velociraptors, and even the magnificent, terrifying image of a mother fiercely slicing off her own melting arm to save her child? What if none of that was a physical rescue operation?
That's a horrifying thought.
What if all of it was the desperate, violent, immunological response of Toivo's own shattered psyche?
Just his brain trying to cope.
Imagine his real physical body lying completely helpless, strapped to a cold surgical table in a concrete room in Vladivostok.
While he's hallucinating all of this.
His mind is breaking under the torture. And to protect his sanity, his subconscious constructs this massive, complex, genre-bending fantasy.
A protective shell of a story.
Exactly. It builds an elaborate, grandiose delusion where his mother is an unstoppable Terminator angel, where his faith is a literal weapon from space, and where he is ultimately rescued and put to sleep in the back of a Jeep.
It changes the entire shape of the narrative, doesn't it?
It really flicks it. It turns this wildly triumphant epic victory into a story of the most profound, tragic, and permanent isolation.
He never escaped.
He never escaped. Thank you for taking the plunge into this intense, chaotic source material with us today. Keep questioning the narrative, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.